Coming up today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, more from an 89-year-old who survived the torpedoing of his ship during World War II and saw a scripture he had memorized become all too relevant.
1,000 shall fall at thy side and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee, because thou hast made the Lord, even the Most High, thy habitation.
Catch the rest of this survivor's story on Hometown Heroes today at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown Heroes.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where each time we take a trip back in time and listen to stories from our greatest generation. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget how great a price has been paid for our freedom. And of course, along the way, we learn what we can learn from these people who were there and answered when our country called. Every so often, we have to spread a veteran story over two programs. And if you missed our last show, you missed Jonas Hofer tell us how he broke his back as a high schooler, didn't know if he'd ever even walk again, but after a remarkable recovery, he was a great pole vaulter and ended up enlisting in the Navy at age 17. We heard about his time aboard the light cruiser USS Houston and the torpedoing of that ship. Most of the ship evacuated after the first torpedo hit. Jonas remained aboard, and when the crippled ship was torpedoed again days later, he would have to abandon ship as well. He was floating in the water overnight, a total of as many as 16 hours before he was picked up the next day, rescued by the crew of the destroyer USS Grayson. If you missed that last program with the first half of his story, I hope you'll pull up the podcast online, because there were some pretty intense and noteworthy moments. But as we enter into the rest of Mr. Hofer's story today, let's pick it up with his description of that time that he spent in the water near Taiwan nearly 70 years ago.
There was a lot of wood and stuff and seats and different things in the water. There was a lot of that stuff in the water, a floating metal and some metal and that there. See, the tornado had went through there about 3 days before that, and so we had white caps go over our heads all the time, and you was wet continually. But the water temperature was 87 degrees, so it was warm when you started out. But by the next day, when you'd been in it over 12 hours, I think I was in it, I'd say 14 to 16 hours, somewhere in between. I was so weak from being in the water so long, and of course we hadn't eaten in maybe 30 hours, that I couldn't even climb the ropes on the ship. What the Grayson did is they couldn't stop, because then they'd get a torpedo. So they kept going, but they put a boat. And the boat took one circle, picked up eight of us, and then while they were picking us up and we was getting on, a torpedo went under the ship. The sailors said it had been set a little too deep, maybe for a battle wagon or aircraft carrier. So then when we got up, of course, and got on, two sailors came down and got me under the arms and brought me over the, because I couldn't climb, I was just so tired and that. And then Dyke says, well, let's thank the Lord. So we knelt down there and prayed, and there were about 100 sailors around us, plus officers and that. And I can remember when we prayed, there was just all quiet. There was really respect, and I really appreciate that when we, and so after I prayed, I looked up kind of, and I saw these guys all standing with their hats over the like that there and looking down that. So we were really respected because we had the Bible classes, I think. I think that's why. I don't think they would have done it otherwise.
And along those lines, maybe some folks aren't familiar with what the navigators were as they were founded during that time period. How extensive was that program on your ship?
Well, the officers and the captain was for ours, for us having those there. Because they figured that the more guys that followed the Bible, the less problems they'd have in and shore patrol and stuff like that, which was right, yeah. So we would have every Monday night from 8 till 9 o'clock, we would have Bible studies and verse go over some of the verse memorized the guys were, and find out how they're getting along in their Christian life and that. Of course, we had a lot of booze. You know, the guys called us preachers and Bible thumpers, and they had a whole bunch of names. But in the wall, in the water there, they swam up to us and were all very good to us and that there. And even aboard ship, like I say, while we prayed there and that there, of course they realized, well, here these eight guys were just saved out of the water and that there, so they have something to be thankful for. And we were. And then what you did in your Bible studies and that, we started a Timothy program, which the Navigators did. You would take one guy out from the other sailors and that, and you would work with him for about 6 months and just tutor him and get him into the Bible study and that. And then 6 months later, he did it too, so you were doubled. Dawson Trotman had it figured out that if everybody would do this every 2 years, get two like this, and then four, and then 16, in 13 years, everybody in the world would have been a navigator. Well, some of the guys never did, so you fall through that there. We started out with the two of us and started, and by the time the ship was sunk, we had about 30. We had about 30 guys that came to our meetings every Monday night. And that.
So you were one of the leaders, the originators of this on your ship.
I'll have another thing is I worked with the church, the chaplain, and I read a lot of books, still do. About one a week. Well, anyway, so he had me help in the library. So we got crowded. There was about eight of us down in our little, where our bunks were at and that, and where we got together for prayer and that. And so Dyke said, why don't you go ask the chaplain, you work in the library some, if we could use the ship's lounge. The ship's lounge had about 30 seats in there. And so I went and asked the chaplain. And the chaplain says, what makes you think we need Bible studies aboard ship? I said, well, everybody can gain with Bible studies. And then, have you been to a seminary? I said, no, I've been to no seminary. Well, I forbid you to teach them. He says, without the seminary training, then how can you know the Bible? I said, I've studied it all my life and that there. He says, well, I forbid you. So 2 days later, I was steering the ship when the captain came up and says, Hofer, what's your problem with the chaplain? Why? He said, he put you on report, captain's report. That's like you have a small court and the captain judges you and that. The only thing I can figure out, I ask him to use the ship's lounge. And he says, what for? And I says, for these Bible studies and navigator material. And he says, I will forbid you. And I says, if I can't have Bible study, I'm in the wrong Navy. The captain says, well, when do you meet? I says, we meet on Monday nights. This was about a Wednesday or Thursday. And it says, have your next meeting in the ship's lounge. I'll be there. Wagner will be there, the other officer, and the chaplain. But do the meeting the way you always do them. Don't change anything. Just do them that way. Okay. Well, it was my turn to have the meeting. We took turns. I did more praying that week than ever done before. Went to the meeting. We had our meeting regular. The captain was there. Wagner was there, administrative officer, and the chaplain, and about 15 guys in that day. Because it was a little beer, and because of more room, they wanted to see what was going on. So afterwards, they saluted and left the net. The next day on the bulletin board in the ship was, from now on Monday night, there will be a navigators meeting in the ship's lounge. From 8 till 9, the smoking lamp will be out. There will be no gambling aboard ship between 8 and 9. You're all invited, and Hofer and Dyke are holding the meeting. and using navigator material. So it just turned around. Then something else happened. 2 weeks later, Captain said, I remember I was steering the ship when he said, told the executive officer, says, we'll have communion Sunday. Says, go get the wine and everything. So he came back, Wagner came back a little while later. We have no communion wine aboard ship. Captain says, that's funny. I signed for 8 gallons in Sydney, Australia, just 2 weeks ago when we were down there. You check again. He went and checked. Well, he says, I finally came back about 20 minutes later. He says, I found out that the chaplain and 2 Marines had drank all the communion wine. A week later, here, another ship came up close. They put a boatswain chair, which on a rope over, and the chaplain was leaving, sent back to the United States. So we didn't have a chaplain a month later when the ship was torpedoed.
Well, that's a great story, and I'm impressed with the courage and the follow-through you showed there. I imagine that was a little intimidating situation there for a while, but it must have felt really good to see how it worked out.
Yeah, it was, but we knew who was in charge. Yeah, man, it was the good Lord was in charge. And this Herman Dyke was not a normal sailor. He would push, boy. He wouldn't take no for an answer. And so we just kept on with it. I don't know. It never bothered me when the sailors called me preachers and virgins and Bible thumpers and all. Didn't bother me a bit. But it was sure good in the water to know that they respected you then. And you're the same ones. And I had found in the Navy, usually the hardest guy was the first guy you could win. It seemed like the guy that wanted to take you out and get you drunk and tattooed and all that there was the first guy that would actually, when he changed, would really change, you know.
Not to put you on the spot, but it sounds like this was such an integral part of your Navy experience to have these Bible studies and the amount of time you devoted to it and all that. So one question that comes to mind when you talk about all the scripture that you memorized, was there a particular verse or passage that still today you look back on and say that was really meaningful to me during that time period?
Yeah, the one that was really real to me when I was in the water was because I had seen, you know, when we got the first torpedo, there were probably 4,000 men in the water because the Houston, there was 1,000. Canberra was another 1,200. That was an Australian ship that was sunk. There were 2 destroyers sunk then, and another one was the seagoing tug and that. So there could have been 3,000 to 4,000 guys in the water and that there. And here, 8 of us were picked up only out of that, all of those. And then the captain got out of there because that torpedo went out. So then later on the Kula Gulf, I started with another guy. We started the Navigator program on that. Of course, in those days, there's altogether different attitude in the Navy. I'd say about 50% of the sailors at one time or other went to a Sunday school or something then. A lot of them came from the Midwest. And so it was just natural for them to be interested. And we had a lot of Catholics, sure, that were with us on that, probably more Catholics than anything else that would study with us and that. And then one of the verses I learned, the whole chapter of Psalm 91, but it starts about in 7, 8, and 9, it says, 1,000 shall fall at thy side and 10,000 at thy right hand, but it shall not come nigh thee, because thou hast made the Lord, even the Most High, thy habitation. I took that verse kind of as my own. And I had seen 1,000 guys in the water, you know, picked up by the Japanese, a lot of them, and different camps and that there. And here, 8 of us are picked up, kind of like a miracle, you know. Yeah.
Almost sounds like that verse was written with you in mind.
Yeah. He that dwelleth in the secret place of the Most High shall abide under the shadow of the Almighty. I will say of the Lord, He is my God, Him will I trust.
And clearly he was worthy of that trust. While you're in the water, 14, 15, 16 hours, that's a long time to be in the water. During that time, did you ever fear that you wouldn't get picked up or that you might get picked up by the wrong side?
No, I don't know why. To this day, when I think back how I felt then, I always felt to be picked up by the U.S. I just had, maybe I was just too young to be scared. Yeah. And no, I just planned all night that the next day when got light, we could see what ships were around. And we didn't do it, but a lot of them, when they were in the water, and if they came over and strafed, then they would get under the water, in the water, until the plane went over and that. We never had to do any of that. Nobody strafed us or came after us. Of course, we were out there by ourselves. I couldn't see another sailor as far as you could look on the waves and that there when we got picked up. But there were eight of us picked up, so that boat took about a half a mile round like that there, and the destroyer just kept going about 20 miles an hour so they wouldn't get torpedoed. And then the boat came close, and the ship never stopped. It kept going while the guys were getting us on, and then they got out of there. I never feared that we weren't going to get picked up in that.
Even though the statistics say you were pretty fortunate to get picked up, and I guess this is a bit of a dumb question, but if there were eight of you,
Well, some of my friends and I were picked up by some other ships, other destroyers and that. The big ships wouldn't stop for you. The battle wagons, cruisers, and them, they couldn't afford to stop. They had too many guys aboard ship, you know, and that's when you get torpedoed the easiest and that. Yeah. So they would keep patrolling at 25 miles an hour. But then the small ships, destroyer escorts and them, the Phoenix was a cruiser that picked up about 25. And then when we came back to the States, there were about 100 of us on this old bucket, the SS Typhoon from Australia to Hawaii on there. And they were from the Helena, some from our ship, the Houston. There was the eight of us. There was no other Houston on our ship coming back from Australia. But they had been picked up and other ships were coming in. So in San Francisco, we met. We had very few guys picked up by the Japanese from our ship because the battle was going and the Japanese couldn't spend time picking up people either.
Well, that makes sense. You might get yourselves killed just trying to save someone else. It's time to take a break. When we come back, we know Mr. Hofer's life was spared, but many more were not, and we'll touch on that when we return. We'll also hear about the little system of code he worked out with his family so they'd know where he was even when he couldn't spell it out for them in his letters. Pretty ingenious stuff. Before we're done today, Mr. Hofer will speak to his experience with Honor Flight and his recent visit to the National World War II Memorial as well. More of Hometown Heroes right after this.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, continuing our conversation with 89-year-old Jonas Hofer. He has related his experiences aboard the cruiser USS Houston in World War II, not the one sunk in the Battle of Sunda Strait in 1942, but the Houston crippled by torpedo bomber attacks in 1944 near Formosa, what we know now as Taiwan. The Houston would be torpedoed again days later after most of the crew had evacuated. By the way, I've added more photos of the Houston and the damage it sustained to the Hometown Heroes Facebook page if you want to take a look there. You'll see what Jonas Hofer looked like as a young Navy man, too. Mr. Hofer was on the ship for both torpedo attacks, but in between those two, those of you remaining on the ship had to do something to honor those killed in that initial attack.
Well, we had a burial of about 40 guys in that time. And what we would do is then, if the guy was dead, you'd check him out and you'd put an M on their forehead. And then you'd take a 5-inch shell and put it between their legs and wrap canvas around twice and sew it up. And then you'd put them on a board like this here against the ship's railing. And then I'd play taps and they'd dump it like that and the canvas would go out from underneath the top covering and that there.
And they would slide into the water.
You couldn't haul them all in, you know, because you didn't know when you're going to come in to shore and that. And they would... Our power was all out. We had no air refrigeration or that anymore. And there were about, I suppose, from 40 to 60 guys that were still in the water down there, and you couldn't get them out. This was all topside guys. And we buried 10 at a time. So we did four times. So I say there's 40 that were buried.
And you just answered my next question. I was putting two and two together saying, if you're the head of the bugle crew on this ship, that you might have had to play taps. What was that like for a burial at sea, to be the guy where everyone's attention is on you, and you know what a somber situation this is?
I always said you didn't have to worry about vibrato. It came automatically. You had to really concentrate, you know, not to think that these are your friends that you're burying now and that you wanted to play the taps right. You had to really think about that there. And afterwards, the officers all came up and thanked you and figured, how did you keep your cool on that there? Well, I had a hard time.
Did you lose any close friends on that ship?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Although from our division, the navigation, of course, we were all in the bridge. We only lost one guy, and we lost him in the States. I won't say his name. But when we got ashore and that there, some of the guys had quite a bit of money on them, maybe from $600 to $1,000 that they had saved up or got gambling and that there. So of course they hit the beach, you know. And one of these guys, as far as we could tell, in the morning they found him dead in the alley. He had been stabbed to death. But they remembered him and a girl leaving that bar and that and going, they think they went to a hotel room. Nobody knew the girl or that there and that, so we never did find out exactly, but the papers had in there that she probably killed him for the $1,200 worth of the money.
So after surviving all of this, surviving the time in the water, getting rescued, finally getting something to eat again, getting your wits about you again, they brought you back to the States and said, hey, we've got another ship for you to go on. Were you excited to get on another ship, or had you had enough at that point?
Before that, we went to Hawaii, and Hawaii gave us a month's survivor's leave at the Royal Hawaiian Hotel.
Tough assignment.
Yes, and they gave us surfboards to use, golfing clubs and all that for a month. I didn't know I was in the Navy then. The day after that month was over, we were in the Navy again, heading for the States. Then we got to Treasure Island, and for 3 weeks we were on there, and they were getting our written reports. And then I got another month's survivor's leave at home. Got to go fishing with some cousins and that. And then I went back. I was assigned to the Kula Gulf and had to go up to Bremerton, Washington, where I caught this ship here.
Well, you mentioned another month of survivor's leave at home. Did you tell your mother everything you'd been through? How did that go when you saw her again? And
no, well, just that we had been swimming. No, you didn't tell your mother very much at all, because she wouldn't want you to go again, that's for sure. But she knew it was rough. We had a plan. My mother knew always where I was at. I had bought two maps when I was home, and I put numbers by 40 of those different spots throughout the world. Casablanca, a few over there, but most of them South Pacific, because I figured we'd be there. And so when I wrote her a letter, and maybe I'd write in there, oh, I saw the funniest thing. There was a guy that was 38 pounds, and that meant 38 watts, walking down the street, and he was a little pig man. He weighed only 38 pounds, but he was walking like a grown man. Well, she took that 38, went to the map. Oh, that's this island here. That's Guam. And so they knew where I was at by my letters and that. Of course, sometimes it took your letters 2 or 3 weeks to get home.
But you found a way to beat those censors who would have cut that information out if you had spelled it out.
In your letters, you know, there'd be big black spots that they would just mark through, because all your mail was censored by the officers, yeah.
Maybe you know the answer to this, or maybe you don't, but when your ship was under attack and torpedoed and all that, in that aftermath, was your mother ever in a situation where she didn't know if you were alive or not?
Here's something else. Our ship was sunk October the 19th. My mother couldn't sleep that night at home. Now, this is unusual. So she thought, well, I'm in the most dangerous place there is. I'm the only one in the service. So she got up and prayed for me that night. My brother was going to Biola then in Los Angeles. He couldn't sleep either. But my mother circled it on the 19th on the calendar. So when I came home later and started talking to him and that there, and my brother did the same thing. He couldn't figure out why did he think about me so much? That must be for prayer and that. So they marked that 19th of October. When I came home, my mother told me about that. She says, what happened on the 19th? I says, 19th is when we got our second torpedo. We had to get in the water and that there. And, well, were you ever afraid you won't go? No, I was too young to think about that. And so she couldn't understand that at all. But when we checked it, both of them had the same dates on the phone.
When October 19th rolls around on the calendar every year, I think about it a lot because that's my birthday. But I wonder if you... It's my birthday, but I wonder if every October 19th, do you take a moment and reflect on that date's significance in your life?
I usually remember it, yeah, is, today's October the 19th. Yeah, I think about it, yeah, and I'm thankful to the Lord. I mean, when you think of only 8 of us picked up that time, getting in out of all those guys and that there, something was really going on.
When you tell people that story, and maybe... I'm sure there are parts of those that you don't tell all the time. Have you ever had anybody say, that's too hard to believe?
Never have. Really, that's a sounding thing. No, I did have once when, for something else, we had a store and I had a friend who came to the store in Dinuba and I was cleaning this. I swept the sidewalk off in front of our store all the time in the morning before everybody else came. And a friend I hadn't seen for 30 years came from Sacramento, come walking up and says, Jonas, what are you doing here? And I says, I'm cleaning the side. Well, he says, my mother's living in town here, and I hadn't seen him since high school. And he says, well, I came to visit my mother and that here, and would you want to go out today for lunch and that? I says, yeah, come down here and we'll go. So we went for lunch. I felt like, you know, I never told Lee my testimony. In high school, I hadn't. So I said, Lee, should I tell you my life story? And I told him all about this ship and saving that, having a family, 6 kids now and some grandchildren, and how good the Lord has beaten me. And well, he says, you think of it, you know what I think about that? It's a bunch of BS. It didn't bother me because I told him, I says, this is my life story and I'm just telling you what it is. And that 3 weeks later, he was there again. When I was at EG, he rode the bus here from the Greyhound bus in the morning. Got there about 9 o'clock when we opened up the store. Want to have coffee? And I says, yeah, okay. And as soon as the others come, we went out and had coffee. Well, he says, since I last talked to you that time, I couldn't get that out of my mind. Because look at how I've wasted my life. I was 12 years in prison. He says, I thought of how rotten my life was and that. So, yeah, this was Monday. Yesterday, I went out above Sacramento in the woods over there and I tied a rope around my neck. I was going to kill myself. But he says, I got in a tree and I tied the rope up. And then before I could jump, I heard, but God. I looked around, see if there's anybody else, nobody else there, and I thought, what in the world? I got ready to jump again, and this time louder than before, the same thing. I took the rope off and got down, got on the bus, and I'm here now. What do you think that is? And I says, Lee, it's God giving you another chance. That's all it is. He's giving you another chance. And he says, well, I'm not quite ready for that. But he says, I have had about 12 years in prison, 2 different times. So my life has just been shot. Never got married or anything like that. I says, well, Lee, I'm still saying you got one chance. God's giving you another chance. About 5 days later, he came. He says, well, you know what happened? Sunday night, I was, and he could play every instrument. In the prison, he learned how to play all the stringed instruments, and he was good. He'd come in the store and sit in a chair and play whatever person wanted. And he said, I was at this meeting the other night at the Full Gospel Church, and the pastor looked down, and he looked at me, and he said, there's somebody down there that you got the last chance. God has given you the last chance. He says, I looked around at that, and he's pointing right at me. He said, So afterwards, I was so convicted after the service, I went up there and I accepted the Lord. So we had dinner together, and from then he stayed in Dinuba for the next year, and I tried to counsel him and help him along and that thing. But he was a changed guy.
Well, and it sounds like the power of your story and your convictions had a role in helping him make that change. Good for you. And speaking of change, let me change gears here and get you to the second ship you served on during World War II. We've talked so much about the Houston and how you survived, and then you had your recuperation in Hawaii and back in the States, and then they assigned you to the escort carrier USS Kula Gulf.
I was on a Kula Gulf for 44, 45, and then in 46, the Kula Gulf was a very, very lucky ship. We were strafed, but the bombs always missed. One time the bombs was in 20 feet of the ship, put up and went off and hit the water, put so much water on it, washed two guys off the flight deck, and the flight deck is 60 feet above, so that tells you what kind of wave that put over. And we never did find them. But they always missed the ship. All the kamikazes and that there.
And this is a big target. I mean, this is a carrier.
2 football fields long, and the Franklin, which is 1,000 feet long, 900 and bigger even than that, was beside them when it was hit by a bomb. And although they did get the fire out, but they lost 300 people in the fire and that there. So we were afraid. I've seen other ships sunk right around us that the battle wagon that shot them, and eight holes in them, you know, a whole salvo.
Is this at Okinawa?
Now, this was above the Philippines when we took the Philippines back. I always thought, a lot of people think, that we did a bad thing by using the atomic bomb. But I said if we hadn't used the atomic bomb, we could have lost another million people. Because Japan was gearing up for over there. They were teaching their, I know this from our friends, 13-year-old boys to be on the beach and give themselves for that. And the kamikazes, too, were really getting going then, where the guys would give their life, thought nothing about it and that then. But we were very fortunate in the Kula Gulf. And then I was on it when we took it after the war. They made it out into a troop ship. And they put all the hangar, they took the airplanes out. We went into China. We brought 5,000 new Marines to China and picked up 5,000 Marines and brought them to the States. We made 3 trips into the Yangtze River. So I got to see China for about those trips. For the last 6 months, I was there after the war. And just a mass of people, China.
Was there a lot of celebration when you guys found out Japan had surrendered?
Thought it was really wonderful that they put MacArthur in charge, because he was a level-headed guy, regardless of what Truman thought about him. And so MacArthur, you know, asked the United States, he says, now's your chance to send 1,000 missionaries over here. Our MB church started out with missionaries over there. We have 27 churches in Japan today that all started after that, yeah. And the people admired him because he was very fair.
Was it difficult for you to adjust to life as a civilian once you got out of the Navy?
No, that's the difference between World War II guys and after that, Vietnam and some of them, where they were kind of reviled. And in fact, I had a cousin that when he got off in San Francisco from Vietnam, they spit at him. With us, they kind of figured we're heroes and that. We got home and forgot about all of it and went back to school and work and that there. Figured, well, we did our part. I've never felt like a hero. We did what we had to do. And after we got back, we decided, well, my friends were getting all married and that there, so I better find a girl too. And I went back to Tabor College then. My girlfriend was going back there too, so both of us did. Then the next year came back and got married in 48.
Yeah, you were just 24 years old then, and you had had more close calls, more heartache, and even more adventures in those 24 years, I guess, than most of us do. But you had a pretty significant adventure just in the last couple months here, and I want to discuss that when we come back. We'll wrap up our two-part interview with Jonas Hofer by hearing about his experience with Honor Flight. Hometown Heroes will come down the home stretch right after this. If you are a World War II veteran and you have not been to the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C., Honor Flight wants to take you there free of charge. The sooner you submit an application, the sooner Honor Flight can get you to your memorial. In Kern County or the Central Coast, call Lily Marsh at 661-544-VETS. That's 661-544-VETS. Or go to honorflightkerncounty.org. For Fresno, Madera, Merced, Mariposa, Kings, or Tulare counties, check out CV Honor Flight, CV as in Central Valley, cvhonorflight.org, or call Al Perry at 559-970-9853. That's 559-970-9853. Maybe you're the son or daughter of a veteran and you'd like to go along as a guardian. There are applications for that too, and there are other ways you can help. Donations to Honor Flight are tax deductible. We all owe our freedom and liberty to the men and women who put their lives on the line for it. Let's all come together now behind Honor Flight and give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Time to wrap up a conversation with Jonas Hofer that has covered two episodes. Don't do that very often, but I hope you'll agree it was worth it this time. He has quite the story, and he tells it pretty well. The most recent chapter, I think, is worth spending these waning minutes on. Before the break, you were telling us about coming home from World War II, and you said you never felt like a hero. But I know you felt like a hero when you came back into the Fresno Yosemite International Airport after our inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight. I saw your family there. They were right up front where I was. They were waiting for you with signs and the whole nine yards. In fact, hero is exactly what they called you. And the evidence is right there on our Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You can see the signs that they held up. There's one that says, "Great Grandpa is my hero." That's you. And another one that spells out "Dad, our hero" as an acronym, with each letter starting a word describing how they feel about you. Also, you had as your guardian on the trip the Fresno State Bulldogs director of athletics, Thomas Bay, and he shared with me what an amazing experience it was for him to be there with you and the other vets. He was thrilled to death. But I want to hear it from you. Tell us about your experience with Honor Flight and what it meant to you. What'd you get out of it?
Well, actually, when we came back, like I say, we tried to get the forget the war and all that until the last 3 months. And this trip we took to Washington, D.C., I'll never forget it. Until the last 3 months. And this trip we took to Washington, D.C., I'll never forget it. I mean, that's a highlight of my life in that. As much as all this being in the Navy and all that. And we had a wonderful trip. I had the most wonderful guide, Thomas Bay. And I couldn't have had better. And we had three good days, three wonderful days. Everything was so well planned. And I'll have to hand it to Perry and the other person that put them on. They did a very good job. It was a highlight. And there were 69 of us veterans, World War II, and we each had a guide that took care of us. About half our guys are in wheelchairs and that, because you have to be 89 years or older to be in World War II. I'm one of the youngest. I was 17 when I joined, but I'm only 89 now, so there's a few guys that were 89, but a lot of them were in their 90s and are in wheelchairs and just getting... And a lot of them are gone. From our ship, the Houston, that I was on, the last reunion I was on was 5 years ago, and there were 13 of us left then. And three of them have died since. So there's probably 9 or 10 with me, 9 or 10 left. But everybody was older than me. One person from Dinuba, Heinrichs, was 95 last week. And he was on that trip also. He's in a wheelchair and that. But that was a wonderful trip. Everybody treated us. I never spent a penny. You couldn't spend any money. You go into a place and want to get some gum or that, and they give it to you. The people were really thankful for what we had done. Like I say, I never felt like a hero until now.
And looking at the National World War II Memorial itself, seeing the quotes in the granite and every state listed there, and in the Pacific and the Atlantic, and the Wall of Gold Stars, a lot of your buddies that didn't come home. What did you get out of that particular part of your trip?
Well, I couldn't get over the wall that had all the names of the guys from Vietnam there, that whole wall. It seems like it goes on for a quarter of a mile in that there. Of how many guys really paid the price, you know? Well, World War II also, when you figure out the thousands that lost their lives for our freedom and that. And so it's no small thing. Freedom isn't if you don't take care of it and that there. It was so impressive, you just didn't want to hardly leave, you know, when you saw it and that. You saw the Vietnam and Korea, different monuments. The most beautiful place over there that really impressed me is the Library of Congress. That is beautiful. I have been in Europe and Russia and different places and seen in Italy and that, and seen different palaces and that. I've never seen anything as grand as the Library of Congress. Really, it's just beautiful. If you're going to go to Washington, D.C., visit the Library of Congress.
Well, you did tell us how much you like to read, and they've got some great historic books in there, and you had a special lunch there thanks to your congressman. And I know it was meaningful for you to be there at the World War II Memorial and all that, but something tells me there wasn't a moment on Honor Flight that was more meaningful to you than that moment you got back on the ground in Fresno. Tell us about that and what you saw as you exited that gate and came in.
Well, when I saw all those lined up in Fresno, there were probably 30 on each side of us. The sailors, I asked them where they were from, and most of them were from Lemoore. But the others also in that there. And it was just amazing the respect they had for us, who had done a little during the war, done what we had to do. Impressive. I couldn't believe it. And my family was there. And just was so terrific in that there. And then the greatest thing that I had got out of this was a friend was Thomas. He did such a wonderful job with me. I was just watching out. He gave me over 100 pictures that I have of what he took. After I saw he was taking pictures, I quit. I figured he'd take them way better than I did. And he gave them to me. And then he gave me a deal that I can watch on our television also put in. It's just wonderful. It's just really wonderful. Then when we got home, he invited us to a football game. We sat in his booth up there and fed us and whatnot. And then afterwards, they brought the bulldog on, put it in our laps. They have a picture of us holding their bulldog, their mascot, on our laps and that. And we're sending that picture to all of our friends and kids for Christmas.
Yeah, a great memory. And there was another moment that night. That was the night that Fresno State played Nevada. It was a sold-out crowd, and you came down from the athletic director's box at halftime. And during that halftime ceremony, when you Honor Flight veterans were introduced, 41,000 stood on their feet and gave you a standing ovation. What did that feel like?
Well, it's just something that's never happened before to us and that. And it's amazing of the people, the respect they had for us for World War II veterans. It really is amazing. And we're thankful. We're thankful we got such a country that we have so many people that are still gung-ho for freedom and democracy.
Well, I know we've talked about a lot today, and your story, I'm sure there's even more to it that we didn't discuss. But when you think back on everything that you've been through, everything that you've survived, the things that you've experienced even in the last year, what does it teach you? What have you learned from all of this? And what do you want people to know about the life that you've enjoyed?
Well, you know, when we look back, we see many points in our life, or turning points. One of my big ones was when I was in high school and broke my back. And one of the biggest mistakes I made then and what it cost me. And I like to tell my children and others in that there's sometimes very little things in your life that can really change it. That changed my life where I had to be in bed there all year and thought I'd never walk again. But it got me back to my senses, and I'm thankful for that. It really made me think again of health, myself, and my good Lord. And it really did. That was a turning point in my life after that. And we met so many good guys, and we still get together, some of us, for our reunions and that we were aboard ship together with. That's 70 years ago. But they're dwindling. They're getting thin out there, and I'll be gone one of these days, too.
What's your secret to living so long and being in such good shape and being such an impressive, maybe not as impressive as your Charles Atlas picture there from World War II, but what's your secret for staying in such great shape?
Well, I still go to the gym at least 4 days a week. I go on the bicycle for 6 miles, then it's the last 4 days. And then I do light arm exercise and that, because it's still a rule. Muscles, if you don't use them, you lose them. If you use them, and I want to get older and still be mobile and that there. And that's why I still go to the gym and that. And if I would advise people that the exercise is good for you and will have it where you enjoy life more, where you can still get around and that. And I think it's the constant exercise that helps.
So you're ready to arm wrestle?
I am very weak when I think of it, of how strong I was in the service and that. In the last 6 years here, I noticed on some of the weights room that it used to where I used to do here, maybe 7 years ago, I was still doing over my weight, 170 pounds on the leg presses and stuff like that, and maybe 80 pounds on the presses above your head and that. But at one time when I was in the Navy, I did 230 pounds that way. And of course, I was in good shape then and that. And everybody knew that. They called me Superman, and that was my nickname aboard ship. Because I could chin myself with either hand and do all kind of go around the bar and that then.
One-handed chin-ups, very impressive. Well, I think some people might hear this program and say they still think you're Superman. I just want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for telling us your story. Is there anything else that you think we should know?
Well, I have been very blessed. I have 6 children. I have 12 grandchildren and 14 great-grandchildren and a couple more on the way. And so I have been blessed. I'm so thankful that we live in the United States and have all these freedoms we have. And I'm just hoping we don't lose them. And I'm afraid some of them are going if we don't do something about it.
Well, thank you for doing your part. That is Jonas Hofer, Navy veteran of World War II, survivor of the twice-torpedoed USS Houston, helping to remind us all again this time of that axiom I like to close out each edition of Hometown Heroes with, because each week we hear from someone who contributed something to its hefty price. We can't hear from the 400,000 Americans who died in World War II, but those who survive make it very clear, freedom is not free.